Prison is a place of punishment and reflection, two themes that are pretty common across religions, so it may not be surprising that many prisoners turn to faith during their time behind bars.
Religious prisoners, however, can be seen as less than genuine, using a show of faith to gain privileges or get out of prison early.
Our guest Joshua Dubler spent 6 years studying religion in a maximum security prison. He says American prisons may well be the most religiously diverse places in the world.
Joshua Dubler is an assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester, and he's the author of Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. And Joshua, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you spent a week watching and participating in the religious life at a prison in Pennsylvania. Tell us where you were and who you spent time with.
So the book takes place in the chapel of Graterford Prison, which is a maximum security prison about 35 miles from Philadelphia that houses maybe 3,500 men.
And who did you meet there?
The central characters are the chapel regulars. So there's this interfaith chapel, and over the course of any given week, and this is the diversity claim, you have something like 12 officially recognized denominations that host something like 55 or 60 worship sessions, Bible studies, musical group rehearsals. So the central characters are drawn from those people, and in particular from the 15 or so prisoners who work in the chapel, who earn between 19 and 41 cents an hour working as janitors and clerks. So those are the central characters of the book.
Now, you don't use their real names, but you did get close to a trio of guys in there. You want to tell us about them?
Yeah, the central characters, Baraka, Al, and Teddy, all of them from South Philadelphia. Teddy's been in prison since the 80s, Al since the 70s, and Baraka longer than I've been alive. I'm 39 now. So they're all from South Philadelphia. They're all there for homicide. Baraka is goes back to the Nation of Islam. He hasn't been in the Nation of Islam since 1975 when Elijah Muhammad died, but he retains a kind of political, sociological orientation that's true of a lot of the older prisoners, but has been kind of out of fashion. Al used to be in the Nation of Islam, although now he's a Christian, and Teddy is also a Christian.
Now, you walk into any place of faith in America that's not behind bars, and you're going to find differing levels of commitment and engagement with the faith. What did you find in the chapel and amongst the various faiths in this prison?
Right. I mean, as a sort of basic question or point of inquiry, I'm less interested in judging the kind of level of commitment of people in their hearts, and I think it's more of interest that it's such a common sense kind of knee-jerk assumption that prisoners are faking it. I think that's interesting because it tells us a lot about how we think about religion. That is, that real religion is this kind of fixed state of conviction, and how we think about prisoners, which is basically as people who we define by virtue of their crime. So when someone when someone is practicing a religion, we take them to be avowing a commitment to being good, then we kind of assume that they're faking it. As a point of practice, most of the men in Graterford's chapel will tell you some version of something like a prison is a place where you have to know who you are, because if you don't know what you're about, someone else will try to make you about what they're about. And so for that reason, my religious faith is really fixed. I'm really committed to what I'm committed to. That's the story that they tell, and it does seem, I end up feeling somewhat as a kind of secular pluralist, as if I'm, waffling in the wind a little bit compared to the sort of force and fixity of their convictions.
So what do you think they said, that in prison you have to know who you are, and that whatever the answer to that is made them stronger in their faith?
I mean, first and foremost, they're saying that because there's this guy who's there who's not a prisoner and who's asking them those kind of questions. And so speaking, they are authorities about prison life. And so while I was wary to generalize, most of them were quite quick to generalize. As for the strength of the faith, I mean, I'm reluctant to kind of make a Marxist move and say that religious beliefs are nothing but social circumstances. But, you know, I think it is the case that if you think about it developmentally, of you come to prison, early on, you have to figure out where you stand. Early on, that's socially during the day. You're alone at night, and you have to confront your thoughts about what you've done and where your life is headed. And because of the accidents of the First Amendment and because of the way that the Free Exercise Clause came to be interpreted in the mid to late 20th century, you know, we protect the rights of prisoners to practice their religions. So, whereas, you know, during the 60s and 70s, there was a whole lot going on in prisons in terms of programming. There's a lot less of that now, but because of that legacy of the First Amendment, those religious opportunities are as available as ever.
Now, if you look at the great literature about prison, you know, thinking specifically, I guess, right now about Dostoevsky, you look at themes of crime and punishment and then redemption. Did you see these guys being interested in that theme with religion, or are they interested, you know, in going down sort of the philosophical rabbit holes or somewhere in between?
It's funny. I had the opportunity to teach. The 6 year figure that you cite, the first couple were field work, and then I stuck around in the prison because Villanova University, the Catholic university, has a BA program, and I taught a class on Freud, Nietzsche, and Dostoevsky, and actually got to read Crime and Punishment, and was kind of shocked that they didn't quite buy Raskolnikov's religious conversion at the end. But the group of men who take classes is a different subculture than the men in the chapel, although there is some overlap. The story of redemption is, you know, that is for many of them the central story. That's because they are with, you know, their conceptualization of who they are is informed by that idea that many of us share, that they are defined by what they did. And so they are adamant, most of them, many of them in the chapel, about saying it is through my faith, it is through my religious practice that I am not who I once was. That's very important to them. Simultaneously, you do have sort of more open-ended, philosophically minded types. I mean, it's perverse. I mean, there's everything in the prison is so perverse and weird, right? But there's something that the graduate student and the life prisoner has in common, which is that there aren't many walks of life where you have the time and the resources to read endlessly. But I did have that in common with some of these men.
So I guess you could view a prison as a microcosm of religious plurality, which you see, you know, writ large in the rest of the world. Do these guys get along with each other?
Yeah. I mean, this is the culture of the chapel is really the culture of the lifers, and the lifers, you know, this is where they live. And they stand to lose everything if things get out of hand. These are institutions that are control is really the word of the age, and people are constantly concerned that they're going to get placed in solitary confinement, that they are going to be shipped off to another prison in the state, or even to another prison in another state. So they are invested. You know, the day-to-day management of the prison really falls to the lifers in a lot of ways. So yeah, they get along. There are conflicts. There are conflicts, intra-religious conflicts, say between different Muslim sects, and those conflicts sort of trace back to conflicts that existed on the street 20, 30 years ago. Especially the lifers. The lifers are there because of homicides that took place, and these are people that were in different gangs back in the street 30 years ago. So the allegiances of the street kind of carry on in these religious subgroups.
We're talking right now with Joshua Dubler. He's a professor of religion at the University of Rochester and the author of the book Down in the Chapel. And we're talking about what religious life is like in prison. And our guest says it's a surprisingly rich slice of spiritual life. And we want to know, do you have an experience of faith behind bars? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking right now about what spiritual life looks like behind bars. Our guest spent a week in a maximum security prison in Pennsylvania and paints a picture of a diverse expression of faith in America from behind bars. And if you have an experience of faith and religion behind bars, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Joshua, you painted some pictures about the people you got to know as you were behind bars and some of the reasons they were invested in life in the chapel. And I want to know what conclusions you drew. You're a scholar of religions. You identify as a secular Jew. What conclusions did you draw about what this had to say about these people and the way we run prisons?
Yeah, I mean, the book is in structure, I think, reads a bit like a novel, and it's pretty open-ended, and I want the reader to kind of wrestle with these things themselves, but there's a kind of, there's an uncomfortable and obvious conclusion, which is that if you look at how the practices have changed over the years, and if you think about, Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam and a kind of collectivist political orientation. This is the kind of orientation that the central character Baraka still has. If you look at that and what's in the predominant forms of religious practice today, in terms of Islam, in at Greaterford, it's something called Salafism, which is sort of the global movement of which Wahhabism is a part. So it's very concerned with personal purity practices, and you see similar things on the Christian side, very much about individual practice. And so what you find is that this kind of collectivist political ways of being religious that fit with the 1960s have totally fallen out of fashion for these more individualist forms. And the uncomfortable thing is how well that meshes with shifts in how we run our prisons from the 1960s and 70s, where there was a lot of experimentation with empowering prisoners and with democratic procedures, to the growth of prisons over the last 40 years. Since 1970, this is true nationwide and in Pennsylvania and in Wisconsin, the prison population has grown something like 700%, and the philosophy has moved from one of rehabilitation to incapacitation, what's often called warehousing, that we're just about keeping these people forever, and sentences have gotten longer and longer. So in the 1970s, a lifer in Pennsylvania could expect to receive commutation by the time he or she had served 20 years. And again, the same thing is true in Wisconsin. I was reading the blog post by a life prisoner named Harlan Richards before I came on, who describes a very similar story where lifers in Wisconsin used to be parole eligible in the 1980s after 11 years, and now it's 30 years before you're potentially parole eligible. And this is, social norms change, and we think that what we're doing now is just the way things have always been. But in fact, the experiment we've been engaging in collectively over the past 40 years of incarcerating now, 2.3 million Americans is unprecedented.
So how do you think American civilization should be judged according to its prisons?
I mean, it's a paradox, right? We care about freedoms, and we care about them deeply. And one of our core freedoms that we point to, when we tell the story of why are we here, why did our forebears leave England, it's about religious freedom. And we do protect religious freedoms in the prison in a way that is somewhat remarkable. I mean, the First Amendment right to free religious exercise doesn't allow you to do whatever it is you want to do, but it protects your conscience, and it protects in many cases your religious observance. And so whereas in 1970 at Greaterford's Chapel, you could have been a practicing Protestant, Catholic, or Jew. Now you can be any number of these 12 different denominations, and that matters, and that's real. That isn't nothing. I think we can feel pleased with the ways that we try to make room for religious minorities. But simultaneously, this bit of religious freedom is taking place in a monument to American unfreedom, and I don't think Americans generally think about the fact that while we have 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the world's prisoners, and that speaks volumes about whether or not we're living up to our ideals.
Josh, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but you spent 6 days with these men, and you joined in their conversations and their debates. Did this change you?
Yeah, I mean, well, this was, I spent a year and a half intensely there, and, you know, I think about my time there in some way, and this is in a secular way, it has a family resemblance with when they talk about how they took their shahada on such and such a date, or the Holy Spirit filled them with such and such a date. Like, being religious, you can think of it, if you have a strong religious commitment, as you're trying to stay true to an important experience and who made you who you are. And certainly for me, this was such an experience, and I try to be true to it. And to try to represent these men who have been incarcerated for so long.
Well, Joshua, thank you so much for being on and talking about it with us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Joshua Dubler, an assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester and the author of the book Down in the Chapel.
The news is coming up next. Then we'll hear about the Honor the Earth tour in Wisconsin, including the Indigo Girls, who we'll talk to in just a few minutes. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.